This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Support for The Exchange weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy. And this is The Exchange. It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Presidential politics returned to New Hampshire yesterday with Donald Trump defending his views on immigration.
If you want to have strong borders so that people come into our country, but they come in legally through a legal process, that doesn't make you a racist. It makes you smart.
Meanwhile, in Concord, Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson thinks voter dissatisfaction within both parties means this is his moment.
Is this the craziest election that you have ever seen? I mean, really, isn't this crazy? And how crazy is it? I'm going to be the next president of the United States. That's how crazy it is.
Today on The Exchange, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Let's hear from you. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And I have two reporters joining me for the full hour this morning. With me is Kathleen Ronayne. Kathleen is a political reporter for the Associated Press. Kathleen, welcome back to The Exchange.
Hi, Dean.
And Trent Spinner. Trent is executive editor for the New Hampshire Union Leader. Trent, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thanks for having me.
There's a lot of presidential action to discuss in New Hampshire this week. Let's start with Donald Trump's rally in Manchester yesterday. This seemed like a really kind of a sudden event. This seemed to be scheduled pretty quickly. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it was scheduled a few days out. I don't think that's particularly abnormal. I think New Hampshire is going to be a swing state. I think what we're going to see is both of the campaigns spending a lot of time here. We've already seen both of the vice presidential nominees in New Hampshire. And I think that we'll see, similar to what we saw in 2012, we'll see a pretty big fight for New Hampshire, including the candidates on the ground. So this was an interesting event. It was at the Radisson, about 800, 850 people there. It wasn't there was a lot of fiery rhetoric, but I would say that it was a little more toned down than what we saw during the primary. Trump was able to fire up a lot of people leading up to the primary, and in this case, I think that he certainly made headlines, but I'm not sure it was quite as fiery as what we're used to.
Kathleen, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think what's interesting is we're starting to see, at least this week, we saw the presidential campaign, I think, delve into new territory as far as the arguments that the candidates are willing to make. We've seen Clinton hit Trump a lot before on his economic message, on, you know, his business deals, things like that. But this week, the entire campaign kind of revolved around this question of, is Donald Trump a racist? And I think that we saw him at this rally at the Radisson, you know, really hitting back against this idea that he is not a bigot, he is not a racist. And we also saw Hillary Clinton going after this more aggressively. You know, this is something that we've heard her supporters say. This is something we've heard her surrogate say. But I don't know that she's ever really delved into it herself as much as she did this week. And after Trump spoke in New Hampshire, you know, she gave a speech where she talked about how he's, you know, basically, I wasn't there, I don't know her exact words, but basically kind of engaging and bringing out this white nationalist movement, I think what she was calling the alt-right. And we've got Donald Trump, you know, here in Manchester, really hitting back against this idea that, you know, he is not a candidate who wants to help African-Americans, he is not a candidate who wants to help Hispanics, and making the argument that, you know, it's that Hillary Clinton is the bigot. So we're entering, I think, this really interesting space. And I don't know that you typically see candidates engage on the issue of racism in this way, which I think shows you, you know, if it's 2016 and we're having a debate about whether or not a major presidential candidate is racist, that's just not something that we tend to hear, even if there are undercurrents of racism. It's not really brought out into the open as a debate. So that's particularly interesting and something we saw Trump delve into directly here in Manchester.
You know what was interesting about that Clinton speech, and I'm glad you brought it up, was that I heard from several Republicans who said that was actually a really good speech. These are Republicans saying that the Clinton speech was well done. And they were saying somebody should have done that speech much earlier, that that would have been a great speech for Bush or Kasich or Rubio to have done before the New Hampshire primary, and kind of lamenting it as a lost opportunity.
Let's hear a little bit from Donald Trump at the rally yesterday in Manchester.
The real divide in this election is not between left and right, but between everyday working people and a corrupt political establishment that works only for itself. This election is a chance for the great majority of decent citizens to end the rule of a small group of special interests and to return that power to the voters or, as we would say, to the people.
That is Donald Trump speaking yesterday at his rally in Manchester. And Kathleen, this speech, as I said, it was sort of scheduled quickly, and it really was kind of a multitasking by Trump. He talked about immigration. We can talk about that. He talked about, as you mentioned, minority outreach and charges of racism. How do you think it went over overall?
So I actually wasn't at the at the speech. We have reporters that traveled in with Trump.
Sure.
But I think that I think that for Trump supporters, I think that they like it when he is fighting back against what they see as an unfair message machine from the Democrats and from the media and reporters. And so I think that, if you're a Trump supporter, what you want to hear is him, talking about his policies and kind of hitting back on these criticisms that are coming at him. I think in general, this message, his message of, not being a racist and being the best candidate for African Americans, is being met somewhat with skepticism. Particularly because it's a message that he is delivering primarily to white audiences. Mm-hmm. I think that he has yet to go to a majority black audience and talk about this message. One, because obviously, we're seeing more white people than black people show up at his rallies, but there also hasn't seemed to be an effort on his part to really do the outreach and get in front of those communities to spread that message. And so I think there is skepticism about whether this is really a message about wanting to help African-American communities or if it's more of an effort to show to his own voters that he is not racist or to make voters feel more comfortable with him. And I'm certainly not saying that Donald Trump is a racist, and I'm certainly not saying that, I'm not passing judgment on whether the skepticism is warranted or not, but I think that those are some of the criticisms that we're hearing. Whereas on the flip side, this is a message that his supporters really enjoy. And I actually talked to some of his supporters yesterday out canvassing who were saying that it really – they feel attacked and they feel that they are given a label as race of being a racist because they support him. And it was something that deeply bothered them that he and they in turn feel they're getting marked with that label.
It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange at nhpr.org. I'm in studio with Kathleen Ronayne of the Associated Press and Trent Spinner of the New Hampshire Union Leader. Maybe you were at the Trump rally yesterday, or maybe you saw Gary Johnson at the State House. Call in and let us know your thoughts. Trent, let me turn to you. Why do you think Donald Trump keeps coming back to New Hampshire?
I think that New Hampshire is going to be a swing state. I think that every electoral college vote matters. And I think that we're going to see from both campaigns. I think that Trump – let's not forget that New Hampshire was the first place that Trump won. And I think even in his speech yesterday, he went back to that. So I think for him, he feels comfortable here. I think that the campaign thinks – that they are going to be able to compete here, even though they don't have quite as many people on the ground. They are ramping up their efforts here significantly. So, I think that this is a place that both campaigns think that they can win. Same with the Clinton campaign. I'm actually surprised we haven't seen Hillary Clinton in state yet. I would imagine that we will.
Pretty soon.
Pretty soon, yes. They just opened their 16th office in the state. So that's just a sign of how invested both parties are in winning New Hampshire.
And Kathleen, there's been some criticism that Donald Trump's ground game here is not all that good, but we've heard that they're kind of stepping it up a little bit. Do you have any sense at all of how they're doing with that?
I mean, I think that it's a little bit hard to tell, you know, because you can mark this in so many different ways, right? Like you can talk about offices open or you can talk about number of staff and things like that. I mean, I would say that the Democrats and the Clinton people definitely, I think, have more of a presence. Whether or not, you know, the Trump people have been ineffective, I think it's a little hard to tell at this point. I was just out doing some door knocking last night in Derry with the RNC and the Trump people. And, you know, they had a group of about 10 volunteers that were out door knocking. And it sounds like they've got a lot of passionate, you know, volunteers who are into this. But I think the question is really whether or not they have done the work in terms of data and things like that to really know what areas of the state they should be targeting, you know, where they want to be concentrating their efforts. I've kind of tried to get that out of them. Mm-hmm. You know, what, right. Where in the state is important for you? Where are we looking? Where are we focusing the message? And I've not really been, you know, the answer I tend to get is, well, we're focusing on the whole state. And it's hard to tell if that is just because they don't want to reveal strategy or if because there is no focus in a specific area.
You can't be quite sure, right?
Right. And granted, I've not it's been a while since I posed those direct questions to the Democrats, right. So I'm not sure what their response would be. But I think it's a little hard to tell kind of what is what. And I think on the whole, you know, I think the criticism among Democrats and Republicans holds that they are not up to speed of where a presidential campaign would typically be at this point.
You know, it's there's this storyline that we've heard from the national media that has kind of the storyline is that the Trump campaign isn't as organized as the Clinton campaign. And I said, you know what, I just want to see if that's true in New Hampshire. And so I just Googled it. Can, you know, Concord, New Hampshire office for Donald Trump? And what actually came up was the New Hampshire GOP. And I said, let me just see. Let me call and see what would happen. Do they know where I could get a lawn sign? Do they know where I can get a bumper sticker? Do they know where I could volunteer if I wanted to make phone calls? And they did. The person who picked up the phone within 2 seconds could answer all the questions. And I tried making a couple of other calls, and that was the case. So I think there is this storyline about how the Trump campaign doesn't have it together. But in New Hampshire, at least, that's not what I found. Now, that was a pretty you know, that was only scratching the surface. There's obviously a lot more. And I think if you talk to Democrats, they'll describe how much data they have on everyone and how they're going to turn out the vote. And so I don't know. I mean, I just called. I don't know if that's going to be if that's the same case for the Trump campaign.
Right.
But, you know, they do have it together to the level that if you wanted to go pick up a lawn sign, you can.
Yeah. Donald Trump was not the only presidential candidate in the state yesterday. We also saw the Libertarian candidate, former New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson, and his running mate, former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, in the state for a rally. Let's listen to a little bit of what Johnson had to say yesterday.
Whatever it is that you know, whatever it is that you do, apply it entrepreneurially. There will never be a greater reward in your life. Creating your own job, creating jobs for others. And when it comes to government, government can play a role in making that as easy as possible.
That is Gary Johnson talking at the State House yesterday in a rally with his running mate, former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld. And Kathleen, what do you think they're up to in the state? We haven't really seen them as a ticket. I think this is the first time they've been here as a ticket. Is that correct?
Yeah, and it's kind of surprising to me because I think that New Hampshire would seem to be a state where Gary Johnson might be able to do pretty well, right? I mean, we're the live free or die state. We know we've got a bit of a libertarian ethos here. We know that, I mean, just anecdotally, as everywhere, there are a lot of voters here who are really unhappy with their choices. I would say the majority of people I stop and talk to on the street don't like either candidate. So, I mean, there's a huge potential, I think, for him to do well here. And I also think that you know, we're a small enough state that it's relatively easy to campaign here. It's not like he's trying to go to Ohio and set up some massive operation. So I've been pretty surprised that we've not seen him more. Right. I don't know why we haven't. I would think that if, you know, they wanted to really make a serious play at this, you would see him on the ground in a few more states. I actually don't think he's yet on the ballot here. I think he has until early September to get on the ballot. So you would think that there would be maybe a little bit more effort in terms of generating interest here to ensure that that happens. I just don't know that I've, you know, And I guess right now a strategy is probably, I think, what you have to get above 15% in national polls to get on the debate stage, right? I think that's the threshold. So it would make sense that his strategy right now is very TV focused and trying to get that message out to a national audience. But, you know, if he really thinks that he's got a shot here, you can't just suddenly build up. As we know, as everyone has knocked Trump with, you can't just suddenly build up a serious ground game, you know, with 2 months left. So I'm not exactly sure how serious he really is about doing well here.
Trent, do you think that Johnson will make that 15% threshold to be in the debates?
You know, so he came to our office yesterday, and that was one of our questions was, you know, how serious of an operation is this? And he thinks that there hasn't been really any significant national polling, but they think that some of their internals show them around 10%, but with pretty small name recognition. So their hope is that over the next few weeks, they can build up that name recognition and get them over that 15% threshold. They are on the ballot in 43 states. Mm-hmm. They're still collecting signatures in New Hampshire to get on the ballot here. They said that they spent a significant amount of money getting those signatures in New Hampshire, and they think that they will be able to do it. I believe you need to get 1,500 signatures in each of the congressional districts to be able to get on the ballot here, and they had some folks out getting those signatures, so they think they'll be okay. And then I was at the rally last night. I stopped by on my way home, and you know, I would say that the crowd was very passionate. They were hoping for about 1,000 people, and you know, I don't have an official number, but I'd say it was somewhere between 150 and 200. But the folks who were there were very passionate, and these are people who we've seen before. I recognized a number of people in the crowd, and these are people who have both been who I've known to support Democrats and Republicans, and you know, that's what Johnson and Weld kind of hope to do. They hope to pull equally from people who are not Democrats who are not happy with Hillary Clinton and Republicans who are not happy with Donald Trump to get them over that 15% threshold. And they think once you're over that threshold and you're on the debate stage, that they could do pretty well.
Do you think what do you think, Kathleen? Do you think he's going to get the 15% threshold to be in the debates? I would think if he doesn't make that threshold, you're essentially almost invisible as a candidate in the fall. And, you know, we often hear about how voters tend to go back to the two major parties in the final crunch.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to tell. I mean, I definitely think there's a chance that he could, but I think he's got significantly more work to do. And I think the other challenge, again, I understand why the focus right now is on just getting up that name recognition and getting out that message. That's really where his focus should be. But at a point, you know, if he does make that threshold, a lot of voters will talk about voting third party. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, people want to feel like their vote mattered, and people don't want to feel like they threw away their vote. And I think that these third party candidates, Gary Johnson, Jill Stein, they're going to need to do something more than just say, well, I can win. They're going to need to prove to people that they can win. And that starts with, you know, campaigning as you would see a major presidential candidate campaign. Obviously, that takes money. But I think that, you know, they're going to need to step up their efforts if they want voters to take them seriously.
Well, we need to take a brief break. We'll come back. We'll talk some more about the presidential race. And then we'll shift gears and talk about statewide races here in New Hampshire. So stick with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, it's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send an email to exchange at nhpr.org, and I'll get it here in the studio. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter as well. And I have two guests with me for the remainder of the show, Trent Spinner, executive editor for The Union Leader, and Kathleen Ronayne, a state house and political reporter for the Associated Press. And Kathleen and Trent, let's go to the phones right off the bat here and talk to Mary in Warner. Mary, welcome to The Exchange.
Yes, good morning. I just wanted to comment on Kathleen's comment concerning the Trump canvassers and sure. how they're upset about being pigeonholed as racist themselves. And, well, the fact is they're supporting a racist candidate. I mean, his comments about Mexicans being rapists and murderers, his accusation that the judge that is trying him is a racist because the man was born in America. He's an American citizen, and that he couldn't be he could not be unbiased towards Trump because Trump called him Mexican. The fact that he made fun of Captain Khan's parents, what more evidence do you want? But my point, Mr. Spiliotis, is you never questioned her on that. You never came back and commented and said, well, wait a minute. There is a reason why these people are being pigeonholed as racist supporters, because they're supporting a racist candidate. And that's why Trump is getting away with what he's getting away with, because there are no follow-up questions. Last week, same thing happened on NPR when David Green, Morning Edition, there was a comment about, there was a show about, an episode about these two neighbors, and he was putting inflammatory signs up to anger his Clinton supporter neighbor. And they were laughing about it. The interviewers, David Green was laughing about it. That's no laughing matter. I mean, I just don't even understand where this is going. And
okay,
why
well, let's,
there's no follow-up.
Mary, thanks for that call. Let's give Kathleen a chance to respond.
Yeah, so just to Mary's point, I would say, first of all, you know, my comment, I did not and was not passing judgment on the validity of these Trump supporters' statements. I was simply sharing something that I had heard from Trump supporters.
Sure.
So as far as that goes. And I think that, you know, there's two things going on here. One, you know, there is a legitimate debate going on in this election over whether or not Donald Trump is a racist. I think we saw it, you know, we saw it play out this week. His supporters would say that they do not believe that he is, and that's their right to believe that. And I think that, you know, reporters have, you know, fairly published the things that Trump has said, and it's up for people to make their decisions. The other point would be, I think that, you know, the way that some of these people are feeling is that so you support a candidate, and I think most people would say that they never support a candidate 100% and 100% the things that candidate believes or says. So I think, you know, this idea that because a candidate says or believes something, that all of their supporters agree with them 100% on every single issue, I don't really think that's fair, and I don't think that on any side people should be people should be linked to 100% of what their candidates say. And I understand, you know, Mary's point, and she's welcome to have that opinion. And
absolutely.
I think this is a debate that's going on. But I'm simply stating how these people are
and
feeling.
I think this whole debate about Trump and whether he's racist, I mean, there's been a very vigorous discussion about this in the news. A lot of talk in the last few days about the alternative right and his flirtation with Breitbart and all those folks. So, you know, the question is whether or not is it the responsibility of a reporter or even of me to prosecute the case against Trump? I think there are plenty of people who do that in the Democratic Party. But certainly Mary is welcome to share her opinion with us. And Trent, let me go to you. And just real briefly, you had a chance to actually talk with – I want to go back to Gary Johnson. You had an opportunity to talk with Gary Johnson at the Union Leader. Just hear some quick thoughts from you on that.
Look, anytime you can sit down with a presidential candidate and talk about a potential of a zombie apocalypse, I think it's a great day. He was joking around. We were talking about we take questions when we do these interviews live on our Facebook page and our YouTube page. And somebody asked, how can you be a libertarian but also support vaccines, mandatory vaccines? He says he doesn't support mandatory vaccines. You know, his philosophy is basically we want low taxes, and that's essentially what the government should do. All kinds of social issues, people should be able to decide on their own, you know, what they want to do in terms of social issues, and that his job as president, and actually they have this interesting plan where Gary Johnson would be the president, but he would almost be like co-presidents with Governor Bill Weld. Mm-hmm. They were going to share all kinds of duties. And so Bill Weld was there as well. And, you know, and their thought was their team, this presidential team would be, their job is to make sure that taxes are low and that everyone has the right to do what they would like to do in terms of social issues.
Kathleen, let me turn to you real quick. One final piece of information on the presidential level. John Kasich is apparently coming to New Hampshire on Sunday. He was someone who seemed to enjoy his time here during the primary. What do you think he's up to here?
Oh, I mean, I think that, I do think that John Kasich really loves New Hampshire and likes the people and his supporters here. So I think he wants to come back. You know, obviously, and he's going to be here campaigning with Chris Sununu on Monday in the Republican gubernatorial primary. This is actually, I believe, the only primary in the country that he's getting involved in, the only contested primary that he's getting involved in, unless he may be out there supporting some incumbents who you know, are facing a primary challenge. Mm-hmm. Well, he's backing Kelly Ayotte, you know. So it's not entirely surprising. John E. Sununu, Chris's older brother, has been a good friend of Kasich's for a long time and was a big supporter of his through the primary. Obviously, there's 2020 speculation. Anytime a candidate comes, there's going to be 2020 speculation. You know, I think to attempt to suss out now what this says about a future John Kasich run is a bit silly. I think it's natural that John Kasich, a guy who did pretty well in the New Hampshire primary and has – Kasich's an interesting guy, right? He was never able to get a huge share of the vote, but then suddenly had all these people starting to say, oh – man, I wish John Kasich was the nominee. So I think he's in this kind of interesting spot. Like, you don't hear people out there saying, like, man, I really wish Scott Walker was the nominee. You just, like, right, you don't hear that broadly. So I think it's natural that he would be thinking a bit about, okay, is there, you know, potential here in 2020? I don't know that this particular event is, you know, driven towards building this great support for 2020. It's way too early for that. And I think voters, for the most part, don't want to hear about 2020.
Trent, one quick question on this. It seems to me that Kasich is hoping that if Trump loses, this whole sort of division within the party, kind of the rise of the sort of populist working class white message, that this is all going to go away and that they'll go back to sort of more of a traditional kind of establishment style Republican. Do you think that's wishful thinking, or do you think there'd be a place for him in 2020?
It is wishful thinking. There was a recent poll that asked, Republicans, these not independents, Republicans, do you think the party should be more like Donald Trump or Paul Ryan? And Donald Trump won by 2-1. And so people like Kasich, who would, I would say, are in the Paul Ryan kind of wing of the party, they're going to have a tough road to hoe here. And just to disagree with Kathleen for a moment, I think this is I don't think it's too early for the start of 2020. I think what we're seeing is the start of 2020. I think that Kasich's visit is clearly him looking at coming back to New Hampshire. Clearly him thinking that Trump is not going to win. I also think that Mike Pence's visit to New Hampshire, Mike mm-hmm. Pence, who's Donald Trump's running mate, I think that
he and Tim Kaine were here last week, the Democratic.
Yeah, I don't think Tim Kaine is looking towards 2020, but I do think that Mike Pence is. Mm-hmm. Trump and the union leader editorial team, you know, they are, I should say, Donald Trump and the publisher, the union leader, did not get along in the primary. The publisher had a lot of questions for Trump, and Trump decided that rather than answer them, he was going to rip up the union leader and throw it into a crowd. So for Mike Pence to come back and sit with the union leader, I thought that was very interesting, and I do think that that was kind of a push towards 2020.
Yeah, Kathleen?
Yeah, I mean, to Trent's point, I guess I wasn't meaning to say that Kasich's visit is not about 2020 at all. I just think it's, you know, as far as voters go, like they just – they don't care about 2020 right now, I don't think. I think obviously is John Kasich coming and is New Hampshire, you know, the first in the nation state, and is he building something for 2020? Potentially, yes. As far as Mike Pence goes, I'm not sure how he made the decision to sit with the union leader, but it's as far as him coming to New Hampshire, it's pretty much the Trump campaign that builds out his schedule, not mm-hmm. him. So,
well, let's go back to the phones, and we have Patty joining us from Westminster. Patty, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you. I'm calling because I'm a Trump supporter, and I'm very aggravated about everything that's said about him being a racist. I'm very annoyed at the media. All day, I said, all the time I listen to this public radio, and all day long, it's Trump bashing from every host, from every program. Every word he says is twisted. He did not say all the Mexicans are criminals. He may have said a few. He didn't start a thing with that Kaiser Khan. Mr. Khan went on the convention and said things about Trump. And it's just, it's been one thing after another. And I'm going to tell you people, there are tons of us Trump supporters, and we were Democrats. We've all turned Republican for that man. Mm-hmm. And we're not racist. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's Patty from Westminster with a bit of a rebuttal. Trent, let me turn to you because I think Patty's call raises a very important point. I mean, both you and Kathleen are sort of on the front lines of journalism, and you get it from both sides all day, right? The Trump folks get upset about the suggestions of racism. The Trump opponents say he's a racist. How do you deal with that on a daily basis, just in general from a policy perspective?
Well, it's how I know I'm doing my job right. If I get an equal number of calls from both sides that we're twisting one side's words or the other side's words, I think that what we're seeing is that people have there's such a split in this country between Democrats and Republicans. I think a historic split. And I think what now that you don't, you know, you're not just reading the morning paper. You get to sort of snack throughout the day on different media sources. I think that what we're seeing is people who say or who are able to just follow news that fits within their kind of worldview. So a lot of people are not getting that same infusion of outside news or news that maybe they're not interested in or news from a different perspective. So I think that what you see is that people who disagree with a story, even though the story, I mean, you can't point out a single sentence in the story that is biased. People who disagree with the premise, disagree with the facts, will say that the media is spinning or that the media is not trustworthy. I think the Trump campaign has really pushed that line of thinking. And what we've seen as a result is that trust in the media is at its lowest point since measures were taken.
Yeah, Kathleen, your thoughts.
Yeah, and I think we hear a lot of voters on both sides say that they don't trust the quote-unquote mainstream media. And I think that term has become so large that nobody really knows exactly what it means, and people that are saying it don't exactly know what it means. And I think that the advent of very conservative news sources, as well as very liberal news sources that, tell their readers not to believe what they're seeing in more traditional media sources. We have seen it kind of fuel this perception that you can't trust anything. And, another particular, I guess, exchange that I had yesterday with a Trump supporter, I told him I work for the AP, and the first thing he said was, okay, well, I just want you to know I don't trust you at all. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay. And he said, but, I did really like that story that the AP did about the Clinton Foundation. Right. And I said, well, some people say that we're shills for Clinton. Some people say that we're shills for Trump. So I would say that, we're probably doing it right. And there was obviously a lot of pushback on the AP Clinton Foundation story as well. And he said, well, I don't know much about AP, but I just know I don't trust any of you in the mainstream media. And so it's this interesting idea that, I liked this story that your organization wrote. I didn't take the time to evaluate to consider consuming news there because you're part of this mainstream media that I don't like. And I also think it's really interesting that Trump continually bashes publications such as the Washington Post or the New York Times or the AP or CNN as being dishonest liars.
And then he seems obsessed with them.
When Trump has a point to make about something that Hillary Clinton has done wrong, what does he do? He blasts out stories from the Washington Post, right. CNN. So it's become very easy for candidates on both sides to paint the reporters as liars. And I think that that ultimately is damaging because no one feels like there's anything that they can trust anymore.
Well, I think it's fair to say that if we're getting it from both sides, probably right about on target. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. The email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook. I'm here with Kathleen Ronayne of the Associated Press and Trent Spinner of the Union Leader. And folks, let's turn to the race for governor now. A lot going on there. We got some new information this week in the shape of fundraising numbers for all seven candidates. And we have two candidates in particular, Colin Van Ostern among the Democrats and Ted Gatzis among Republicans, who both raised over $1 million. Is that correct? Or have raised so far over $1 million. Is that correct?
That's right.
Yeah, Trent.
Ted Gatzis just he invested $75,000 of his own money to get him over the $1 million mark. But still, I mean, we're seeing a lot of money in this race.
Oh, is that true? He was under a million and threw in the 75 to get the headline?
$75,000 as a loan. That's legal. So,
yeah.
I was shocked to hear some of the numbers. You know, this is this race has kind of been under the radar a little bit, I would say, because I think that the presidential race and the U.S. Senate race have taken a lot of oxygen out of this race, or not given it really the oxygen it needs to land on the front page all that much. But what was interesting to me was how many people donated on both sides and how much money was raised. Kevin Landrigan, now a political reporter for the Union Leader, reminded me, he wrote our story about this. He reminded me, this isn't anything compared to what Craig Benson was able to do. So, these are not historic numbers per se, but they are very large. And I think it shows that there's an undercurrent of support on both sides in this race.
So, Kathleen, let me ask you. For a long time, we had sort of assumed on the Republican side that Chris Sununu was a front runner because everybody was attacking him, and now Ted Gatzis comes along with his big haul. Does that make him the front runner, or is it just kind of a dead heat? What do you think?
No, I mean, I don't think you can say who's a front runner necessarily based on these totals. I think what these totals do show us is who is in a strong position to make an aggressive play, probably in television ads and other things in the final 3 weeks of the campaign, which matters. So Ted Gatzis financially is in a much better spot, I would say, than Chris in terms of how much money he has left to kind of shell out in the final weeks of this race. I do think it's not necessarily surprising that Gatzis's total is so high. He had some of the most prolific, New Hampshire Republican fundraisers with him. I think that if you look at his filing, he locked up a lot of Manchester business money. And something that people have been pointing out about his filing, you have a lot of LLCs that are contributing to him,
which, sure.
And I have not calculated who owns all of them, but New Hampshire's laws are a little bit wonky. So basically, an LLC, I think, can give up to $5,000. And if one person has, five different LLCs, they could give money through all of those LLCs. So you're able to get more than the typical limit from one person. And that, I just want to be clear, that is not illegal under New Hampshire state law by any stretch. That is something that is allowed. People have been critical of it. I don't think Ted Gatzis is total surprising. I was a little bit more surprised by Chris's total because Chris has been in this race for a very long time.
Yeah.
And some of his detractors are also pointing out that he has a fair amount of out-of-state contributions, certainly more than Ted does.
Well, I should mention that all three Democratic candidates for governor will be here on The Exchange next Thursday, so make a note to check that out. We got to take one more break, come back. We'll keep talking in politics, and we also have some other New Hampshire news stories to get to as well. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today on The Exchange, we're taking a look at the big stories in New Hampshire for this week. Let's hear from you. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. I have two guests with me for the remainder of the show, Kathleen Ronayne, New Hampshire State House and politics reporter at the Associated Press, and Trent Spinner, executive editor for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. And Kathleen and Trent, let's go to the phones, and we have Keith joining us from Merrimack. Keith, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Just a quick point or with follow-up of the question. At a recent Trump rally, I saw there was a guy dressed up as a giant parrot holding a sign.
That's right.
that had something to do with Maggie Hassan being Hillary's paradigm. I'm sure that's what he's suggesting.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, that he just repeats that she repeats everything that Hillary says. Personally, I don't see a whole lot of difference between Hillary and Governor Hassan. Is that a fair assessment, I guess? Because as a concerned voter, as a voter, I'm very concerned that I just don't see Hassan ever really going against anything that Hillary has to say if she was to become president.
So, Keith, it sounds like you're concerned about her independence as a potential senator.
Correct. It seems like she just is just following everything that seems to be what's popular with that right now.
And, Kathy, let me turn to you. That would be very different than what we see with Donald Trump and Kelly Ayotte.
Yeah, Governor Hassan has been and continues to be a very strong supporter of Hillary Clinton. She has not wavered in that support. It's very different than what we do see from, you know, Kelly Ayotte kind of working on some occasions to make herself appear more independent from the ticket. What I will say, though, is I think that we have seen Governor Hassan, while she supports Clinton, she doesn't necessarily go out of her way to tie herself to Clinton. And I think we saw, you know, recently she got tripped up in an interview on CNN when she was asked three times if Hillary Clinton was trustworthy and she couldn't say. But I think to the caller's point, you know, Hassan is a Democrat through and through. And, you know, I think on a lot of the national issues, she would be and is aligned with Hillary Clinton. We don't really see her breaking from her too much on matters of policy.
Yeah, there were a couple items like Guantanamo Bay and and immigration in the Syrian immigrants.
Refugees.
Yeah.
There was, I think,
just a little bit
on, more on
separation.
Some national security things. Yeah. We see Hassan being a little bit more hawkish, I think, than some of her Democratic counterparts. And I think in some ways that's a necessity. But I had temporarily forgotten about the Syrian refugees. She did believe that there should be a halt there. And she also does not believe in the plans, the current plan to close Guantanamo Bay. So she is different from Clinton there. But on the whole, her support has been very strong.
She's certainly a lot closer to Clinton than Ayotte and Trump. We could talk about politics for the entire hour, but there are some other important stories in New Hampshire that we need to touch on. And Trent, let me turn to you. There's some more developments on this ongoing contract issue with DHMC, Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center, and New Hampshire State Hospital here in Concord. What's the latest?
Just for some background, Dartmouth College used to provide the physicians at the state hospital. Dartmouth College said they were essentially getting rid of their psychiatric program. Dartmouth Hitchcock, the medical center, moved in, hired most of those physicians, and took over the contract. And what's happened since has been pretty turbulent. There's been a contract fight amongst employees. Some of the employees don't feel like they're being treated well. And then what happened last month is a tragic story of a 63-year-old woman, Joyce Silva, and she was at the hospital. She had a specific plan to commit suicide. There were beds that were available, and for some reason, we don't know why, Ms. Silva was discharged from the state hospital, and within hours, she was dead. She jumped out of a third-story window in Nashua. And we've been following this story extensively. Our State House Bureau Chief, Dave Solomon, broke the story. And what we saw this week was that the Executive Council said, we want to hold off on approving this contract. So Dartmouth Hitchcock, the medical center, they had a temporary contract. They're looking for a 9-year contract, kind of it's really a 3-year contract that could go out for 9 years if it's reapproved. And the executive council was asked to vote on it. There was the governor, the state's top health official, and the attorney general were all or I shouldn't say the attorney general, but the governor and the state's top health official were supportive of this contract. But the council unanimously said, we've seen some of this reporting about the issues at the state hospital, and we don't want to move forward with it.
So what's the sort of the long-term outlook?
Well, the long-term outlook is that Dartmouth Hitchcock and HHS have another few weeks to provide some more information to the council. The counselors had a lot of very pointed questions. Mm-hmm. Why are we seeing, you know, such negative headlines? You know, what went wrong? In the Joy Silva case, the HHS commissioner said, we're going to appoint an independent counsel to investigate what happened here. And it's going to include a state Supreme Court justice, a state police officer, a former attorney general. What happened here is it's called a sentinel event. And under state law, it doesn't necessarily have to be public. You know, we've pushed very hard to make sure that the public understands what happened here. And even in running, you know, Ms. Silva's name and photo.
I was going to ask you, is that unusual?
Yes, it was an incredibly difficult editorial decision to make because, you know, the family asked for privacy. We usually don't cover suicides. But what I said was something wrong happened here. Something very wrong happened at the state hospital. This woman checked in for help. She was discharged. There were beds available. She had a specific plan to commit suicide, and she was able to carry it out within hours of leaving the hospital. And I said, this could happen to anyone. And if there's something that went wrong, being able to put a face on this story is incredibly important so that we can figure out what happened and we can figure out how to make sure it doesn't happen again.
My sense is that the pressure is going to be on DHMC to kind of improve the staffing and the situation rather than – I mean, in theory, it could go back out to bid, right?
It could go back out to bid, and the council had previously asked for it to go back out to bid. DHMC, they were
sort
the only people who
that, right?
Well, no, they were the only people who bid on the contract.
Okay.
It's very difficult. If you talk to medical professionals, they say it's very difficult to find the people who can work at the state hospital. It's a very physical job. You have to have a lot of very specific experience that a lot of people don't have. And so after Dartmouth College stepped away, Dartmouth Hitchcock, they were the only people who stepped up to the plate, who could hire all of those people, who could get the contract, who could get all the sort of necessary pieces in place to be able to do the contract. And so, I mean, that is an option for the council to put it out to bid again. But I don't know who's going to be able to step in and be able to take over the state hospital.
Kathleen?
Yeah, and just one thing that I do think is interesting about this, and I have not reported on this topic more recently, so, you know, Trent may have more information than I do, but initially when this fight was going through the council and they awarded the temporary contract, you know, reporters were asking questions. Okay, you have some psychiatrists leaving. How many staff are you going to have? Are you hiring new people? Are you repurposing existing staff? And the answer that we kept getting from the state and the state hospital was, We have enough.
Right.
We'll be fully staffed. No numbers, no specifics about who these people were, where they were coming from, what the training was, if the staffing levels were going to remain the same. And maybe more of that information has come out through the union leaders reporting. But, you know, from the get-go, there wasn't a lot of transparency about how this transition was going to work. And that always, you know, gives rise to more questions.
Mm-hmm. One other story I want to talk about today, and Kathleen, let me come back to you on this. We've talked several times in the roundup about this incident with the New Hampshire and Massachusetts state troopers beating a suspect on camera after an extended car chase. I guess they'd probably been after this fellow for a while. We've had some new developments there. What's the latest?
Yeah, so the former New Hampshire state trooper, his name's Andrew Monaco, he pleaded guilty this week to simple assault. He's not going to be serving jail time. The judge ultimately did take a plea deal. I think the judge said that he something along the lines of felt that this former trooper was willing to take responsibility for his actions. He is no longer a state trooper.
Basically, ended his career.
Ended his career as a state trooper. Yeah. He gave up his law enforcement certificate. He also has to go through anger management counseling. This was a huge deal when it happened and has continued to be a big deal. But I don't know what the state police have done in terms of responding to this, if they've implemented any type of training. This is, something that I have not been covering a ton. But mm-hmm. at the time, Governor Hassan was asked, some pretty serious questions about it. And I'd be interested in following up to see beyond disciplining this individual officer, if they're needed. I mean, this is not something that we see a lot of in New Hampshire. This is pretty rare. Mm-hmm. But, we have had instances of excessive use of force in the past from local police departments and other groups. So I'm just not sure what state police have done more broadly. But this trooper did plead guilty.
Trent?
State police were incredibly embarrassed about this. They acted very quickly. They suspended him within hours. Massachusetts State Police also suspended their officer who was involved. And both Massachusetts and New Hampshire State Police fully cooperated with the Attorney General's office. If you look at the paperwork, they made all of the officers available. They submitted themselves to extensive interviews. And I really do think that state police were incredibly embarrassed by this. And so what they've done was, my understanding is that Monaco will actually speak to troopers or officers at the State Police Academy to say, if you do that, I lost my job, I lost my career. Monaco was saying during his hearing yesterday that this was his life's dream. He's 31. He'd been a state police officer for a handful of years. He said this is what he's always wanted to do, and it's gone now because of that one day.
Yeah, he turned in his law enforcement certification.
Exactly, yes. And state police have to – he resigned from state police, and state police have to report that to the New Hampshire Police Standards and Training Board. So he's out. I mean, he is done. He has lost his career because of that day, and he's going to be able to say that to troopers and local police officers who are joining the force.
Mm-hmm. And Trent, let me come back to you for one more story. Some recent news, or very recent news, on the civil suit against St. Paul's by the family of the young woman who was assaulted by Owen LaBrie. What have we learned about this civil suit?
Well, just some background. There's the young woman who was assaulted by Owen LaBrie sued St. Paul's, saying that St. Paul's didn't have the adequate protections in place. There was an interesting exchange here where St. Paul's filed this documentation basically saying, the family's attacking us in the media and they shouldn't be allowed to file this case as Jane Doe, that they should have to identify themselves in the civil lawsuit. We reported that. I think the school received a lot of negative feedback about that from the community. Why are you forcing this young woman, a victim of a sexual assault, to have to use her name? And then the school said, no, the media is not reporting it correctly, even though we were able to point to specific parts of the lawsuit where they said this. What we've learned now is that the young woman is going to be able to use her initials in the lawsuit. The whole thing is I think it's difficult for me to understand why there's such a fight about this. I would say 99% of the news media will not report the victim of a sexual assault. We wouldn't report her name. So, and I think people at the school who know about the case already know her name. So I don't understand why the school is pushing this.
Well, I'm wondering, you'll have the parents' name, you'll have the young lady's initials. I mean, how much privacy really is that in the end?
Right. It's not that much. But what's going to happen is that at least at the Union Leader, what we're going to do is we're going to go through the stories and we're going to make sure that there are no identifying factors. So this is a problem all the time. We cover cases where, parents are accused of sexually assaulting children or family members are accused of sexually assaulting, other family members. And we have to really make sure that our stories don't provide enough points of information that if you knew the family or if you lived in town, that you could identify the person. So if that means we take, family names out, or that means we take addresses out of the story, it's something that's really important to us.
Yeah, certainly. This is a very complicated story, and I think this is something we're going to continue to follow in the coming weeks for sure. We're starting to wind down here. Spend a few minutes with each of you, sort of talking about what you think kind of the big stories are going to be coming up in the next week or so. I know it's obviously we're getting close to the big Labor Day weekend. That's sort of a big moment in politics, but also a big moment for vacations. Kathleen, what are you going to be working on in the next couple weeks?
Yeah, so next week I am actually going out on the campaign trail with Tim Kaine.
Oh,
so I'll be doing that. I know we're going to Pennsylvania for a couple of days. I'm not sure where else. It'll be my first time seeing him. So that should be pretty interesting. I saw Mike Pence 3 weeks ago. So it will be interesting to compare them. But really in the next 3 weeks, I'm going to be looking towards the state primary, particularly the competitive gubernatorial primaries. What are these candidates doing in the last 3 weeks to try to make the difference? How are they trying to get their supporters out? I think both of those primaries are pretty pretty wide open. So, and it's been a little bit sleepy, but now is really crunch time, you know, when these candidates have to get out there and try and make their final pitch to voters. So what is that final pitch? What does it look like? I also think, you know, the Frank Yinta's primary is going to be particularly interesting. He's, you know, facing new allegations over his campaign finance issues.
The ongoing FEC issues,
yep.
Right?
And, you know, Rich Ashew and he are going back, I think this is Rich Ashew's first TV ad that went up, and it's an and I believe
and,
it's a negative. Yeah. It's kind of a negative
on Ginta's honesty
spot, yeah. Which is typically you don't see candidates go negative on their first ad. So, and he may have done another ad. I don't recall one
saying Ginta's, that Ashew is soft on terrorism.
Yes,
so they're really engaging.
Yeah,
Trent, what are you up to?
A couple things. So I know there are going to be people listening who have no idea who they're going to vote for in the primary. And I just want to say right now that is okay. You are not alone. A couple of things. If you go to unionleader.com/votersfirst, you will see hour-long interviews that we've done with all of the candidates in contested races. These are really in-depth interviews. We came up with a bunch of questions. People who were watching live were able to submit questions. And so if you just want to know, where does this candidate stand? What kind of person is this candidate? You can go to unionleader.com/votersfirst.
Good and resource.
Then it's a great resource. And then the other thing is, if you don't have time for that, on the Sunday before the primary, Sunday, September 11th, you will be able to pick up a copy of the New Hampshire Sunday News, and it'll have a voter's guide that'll have a breakdown of who all the candidates are, where they stand. It'll be really digestible stuff and help you make your decision on primary day, which is coming up in a few weeks.
Well, we are out of time. I know we're all going to be watching this closely. It is crunch time with that primary on September 13th. I'm sure we have lots more to talk about in the next couple of weeks. I'd like to thank both of my guests for coming in today. Kathleen, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks, Dean.
It's Kathleen Ronayne. She's a political reporter at the State House and on the campaign trail for the Associated Press. And Trent, it's great to talk with you as well.
Thanks, Dean. Good seeing you.
You too. That's Trent Spinner. He's the executive editor for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. And remember, the conversation always continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Jessica Hunt. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm, and our intern is Sam Ruthier. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy.